this thing here? Doesn't it look like? What's this?
Juice extractor.
Oh, it's juice. It's a juicer. And this is a toy. So, a packet for toys.
So we.
Am I getting a with you guys?
We are hearing you just about okay. You're breaking up slightly.
Okay.
My name is May, and I will be facilitating your conversation with the audience.
Okay.
Thank you for sharing with us such a magnificent time travel film. So I guess I will start with asking you about Enrique, who I understand is a very, very small footnote in recorded history, and you have given us your story of Enrique. So much of it is your imagining over 35 years of Enrique's journey.
Yeah, of course. There was that mentioned about in Manuel's letter. Let's see, I'm getting a doctor here. Hello. Okay. See myself. Yeah. Since journal written in the Malacca, Antonio Pigafetta during the voyage barely mentions very much about Enrique. Although everything that, of course, the big star of his book was Magellan. So Magellan did this, Magellan did that. And the few times that Enrique is mentioned in Pigafetta's book just gives me enough milestones to build up the case that possibly the first man to go around the world was Enrique. The rest I had to flesh out. So I tried to imagine what he would have seen in Europe and the kinds of master-slave-master relationship, how it would express itself. Yes, that's a lot of fantasy, but none of it has fallen into the cliché of the cruel master and the poor slave. It's been a playful and even sympathetic relationship, I think, that I developed over the early years of making the film. So definitely Enrique is a creation of my duende. Do I have to introduce the duende in tonight's talk?
And I was curious, because the film took so long, was in gestation for so long, how did your idea about the stories that you would tell about Enrique over the decades, how has that changed?
Okay, hi, Katrine.
Hi.
The film, I thought, would probably take 3 or 5 years to make, but I didn't expect it to stretch to 35 years. Very definitely, there were some decisions in life that just stretched to the period. As I said earlier, I think to some other audiences, that and after 5 years of making the film, around 1985, 86, I was very aware that my three sons were growing up, and I thought it was a good time to get to know them and not wait until until I finished my circumnavigation. So I decided to shelve the film for a few years, and of course I'd come back in 5 or 8 or 9 years, but it stretched on to 15, 20, 25 until it reached 35 years. And it was probably partly a family decision to do that, but partly it was probably also a combination of cosmic circumstances that was beneficial in the end to the film. Like, for example, the guy who plays Magellan in the second part of the film is my son, Kawayan, our son, Kawayan. And he was 2 years old in the early shots in the film. And suddenly, and also in the middle part of the film where the battle scene, he was the guy holding up the turtle while the bells ring. And then 15 years later, he was old enough to play Magellan. He had a beard as bushy and as convincing as that of Magellan, so he sort of took over the role. So those are some of the benefits of taking your time and not following a Hollywood timetable, because you have that play date and the bankers have to start collecting their money from the production. If you don't have those rigid deadlines, time, an extended timetable can be your table, can be your ally, sorry.
So I wanted to ask you some more about this idea of the cosmic, because it comes across so strongly in this film. So it's very intriguing that you say that what sort of propelled you to return to this film and actually finish it is a cosmic force much, much bigger than an individual decision.
Why did I come back?
That was something cosmic about propelling you to come back to this film.
I think there was this tendency for, I had this long time commitment, mainly because I felt that, first of all, I wanted the story to go up. And I felt that the version I had finished in 1980 or 85 still lacked a few elements, like the language lessons and a few more details that I wanted to stress up. Now, for a while, the 33-minute version, I had a 33-minute version ever since 1984, which I was showing whenever I would go abroad, partly because I wanted people that if I don't finish the film in this lifetime, but at least a few people in festivals or galleries or wherever I had lectures to know about the first Filipino to, or the first person to go around the world. So I kept showing this 33-minute version, and a lot of friends said to me, "It looks finished. Why are you still thinking of going back to that and creating more production ethics by going back to that film?" I think instinctively I knew that I wanted more people to hear that story, but I wanted to complete the story so that if I'm gone, I don't have to explain things in a Q&A or to do my performance. It was a way to just spread the word and make a few people think about, hey, the first person to go around the world was not the master Magellan, to whom everybody attributes that first circumnavigation, but that it was a twist of fate that was its slave, Enrique de Malaga. As a matter of fact, I don't know if people if you guys have read I don't know if it's Austrian, German, Swiss novelist called Stefan Zweig. He wrote a novel about, a biographic novel about Magellan, and he does give acknowledgement that possibly when Enrique was chatting with the Cebuanos and laughing and chattering, I think his word was chattering and laughing with his fellow islanders, for the first time on the life of our planet, a man had circled the globe and gone back to the island where he had learned his language, no matter how lowly his status. So it was an acknowledgement by even European writers that possibly then the honor belonged to the slave.
I mean, across your other films, consistently you return to the idea of valuing the indigenous. But what seems...
To which idea? I'm sorry, again?
The indigenous. and particularly the figure of the Indio, the indigenous people and indigenous culture. In this film, what I found particularly intriguing was the gloss that you give to this figure of the Indio, so the indigenous, as also a very worldly figure.
What was the last sentence?
So that the figure of the Indio, Enrique, in here becomes a figure of the indigenous, but also a very worldly figure.
Okay. When I started the film, I was really basically trying to introduce the slave as a cliche slave of who looks like a primitive and works with this European master. At that time, I was more familiar with the Cordillera culture, that's the indigenous people in the north. And so I chose to make him a Ifugao, which also allowed that motive. In fact, the Ifugaos are very good wood carvers. And I think when they're still in the womb of their mother, they're already chiseling away. With that kind of beginning, it was because it took me almost 35 years to reach it. And in the more recent footage, since I had been adopted by Ifugao village, and I got to know them over the last 20 years, or 19 years, I think I began to understand better the juices that makes indigenous people have a certain dynamic with Mother Nature and with the spiritual world. They have a built-in natural balance that doesn't allow them to do what the world is doing today to Mother Nature. We're all aware of global warming, and maybe if we listened a little bit more to what they had to say, I think their wisdom would be a big would apply, would help give cultural breaks to our world today that is going out of balance. Maybe just in relation to this, okay. Since you brought up indigenous, my best friend, did I mention that the other day?
Yes.
Anyway, my best friend, have I, Katrin?
Yes, you did mention it again.
About Lopez Nahuya?
Yeah, do it again.
Okay. Anyway, my best friend Lopez Nahuya, you see in that film, he also mispronounces the word indigenous. He would all speak in that we indigenous people have been taken for granted. That we must fight and defend our indigenous culture. And I thought, wow, it was such he was a very, speaking with his strong dialect accent, and I think it struck me as a very cosmic pronunciation that he came up with. Indigenous, he combined the word genius with indigenous into one word. So that was, I've used that with my students at the university. I even further twisted the word to include the word Indio. So I would say when you guys, my film students, if you're doing your diploma films, why don't you tap your Indio genius strengths? You all know Indio is the Filipino word. I mean, it's the Spanish word for Filipinos or for all the conquered people. All the colonized people were called Indios. So we have been Indianized. We have been hybridized. We have been bastardized. And our culture has. So why not take that as an asset that we are both, but in spite of being Indianized, we are still carrying on with the Indio genius of the old wisdom. And I think it's something that the world probably can still benefit from if we open our ears to. But you know, Katrine was and I have been very much working with indigenous people in the last 15 years. And Katrine, maybe you want to say something about that.
I don't know, do we still have time, Michael? Or should we go into question and answers, I'm wondering. Anyway, basically the essence is the same, like indigenous people, most of indigenous people, because they come from an oral tradition, they are not taken seriously, not taken into the academia, they are marginalized and nobody really cares, because one would need to look with inner eyes to understand them, not just with the eyes of the scientist that only sees the outer things. So I think it is really important to consider these two worlds as co-equal, the inner, listening with the inner ears and inner eyes, and listening with the outer eyes and outer ears and outer eyes. So this has been our work, and from very different angles. I went to university and tried to put that key into the academic lock. It didn't really work so well, but you know, it's a slow process. Indigenous scholarship has started globally, and I think it's important to continue to work on that, to find words for things one cannot say. And in a way, the story of Enrique or Balikbayan number one, in my eyes, it's exactly that attempt. There's somebody who doesn't really exist because he was just a slave, and yet somehow there are traces, and to construct a story from these traces, just to put these colonized subjects into the realm of reality, yeah? Because it's almost, if you have colonized people, you deny their reality, so...
And maybe that's why the slave was overlooked by history, but because Pigafetta happened to mention him, we have this open possibility. I cannot prove that Enrique was the first person to go around the world, but the fact that Pigafetta mentions that he could speak the language when he got to Thailand opens a possibility which nobody can disprove. And on that ambiguity, I have stuck with the commitment to reach the finish line, to reach home port, to sail back into the from where I started to complete the Balikbayan trip. And as Katrine said, I think that becomes the major ingredient that possibly the slave, okay, Magellan was the master of the voyage, okay? In classical terms, the master is the boss. He's the guy who he talks to kings. He's negotiating with bankers, the Augsburg bankers, to get some funds. He talks with university map makers to get the latest information on maps and things like that. And he talks to boat engineers. He is Mr. Logistics. He's always on top, like today, an MTA today would be Mr. Logistics. But the slave just follows him around, does his duties, massages him, brushes his hair, plays, learns chess and all that kind of thing. But without trying hard, he was destined to be the first man to go around the world. But it is his indigenous survivor that I think, not only as a survivor for himself, but he probably had also this, what I call in the film, his indigenous GPS that guided them to those crucial moments, so that the voyage could prove that the world was round, to the Western world anyway.
I'm looking to the audience to see if there are hands going up to ask questions.
Yes.
Hello, really magnificent film. It's good to speak to you. Was there? How did you go about in terms of pre-production, setting up how you would go about making the film?
Let me see. I'm not getting you. Can we repeat that again?
Yeah, sure. So the question was about how did you go about doing the pre-production for this film?
Okay, I think if we talk about the normal production, there's the pre-production, there's a conceptualization, the pre-production, and all this post-production. And I think everything was probably happening at the same time. I first came across the concept of the first circumnavigator maybe in early 1979 after Trina and I just returned to the Philippines. I heard it from a friend who wrote an article about it. I started shooting a few shots maybe of me running around through the sunflower hills of Baguio, which you find in the ending of the film. Thinking that I would show the last phase of his getting back to his village. But then I started shooting mainly in about by springtime of 1980. I was my wife had been doing costumes, and Katrina actually had done the costumes for the film. And once I had that, my only problem was because my cameraman was he was working in Manila, which is 250 kilometers away from Baguio, where we live. And he also had become the highest paid commercials cameraman. So I couldn't afford to pay him that, so I just would wait for him to come home for vacation and to visit his family. So every now and then I would hear that he would be there. Hey, come on, let's do this shot, okay? Let's do this sequence. And if he would agree, we would quickly sew up a costume, and I would look for any thing that looked ajivo, furniture, whatever, and we would do it. So over the about 5 years, we were able to string a lot of 60 millimeter shots that was already giving a kind of flavor to the relationship of the master and the slave. But there was no real production and pre-production, because usually that's based on a written script, right? Once you have a written script, you can costify items that you need, props, a galleon, anything that looks like a castle. And when you have that lined up, then you can go into production and go full steam if you can hire a cameraman on a full-time basis. But in the end, it was stop and go. And until 2012, I had no notion of how I was going to finish the film. Then, okay, maybe I don't know if you would call this a production or a post-production decision. The 16 millimeter laboratories had closed in the Philippines. I was trying to resist video. Okay, fine. Okay, I'm going to use video because it's the only way I can finish telling my story. And once I made those decisions and then found my son being a nice lookalike for the Magellan role, we were back on track. And within 1 year, we finished the version for Singapore. Now, tonight, what you saw was the film, and it's about two-thirds into the film, you see the end, question mark, question mark. Mm-hmm. And then I think people were already getting ready to get out of the theater. And I said, oops, there's still another epilogue, which turned out to be a full chapter. But that happened after the Singapore Art Festival. So there's no post-production or pre-production concept. Everything kept going on. And actually, what you saw today is already Redux 4. Redux 3 was what I showed at Berlin. I don't know if I told you, Michael, that you got the bonus, you got three more scenes.
And you bet.
Maybe in this lifetime I can still finish a Redux 5.
And Redux 6 and Redux 7.
Maybe
maybe next life.
Maybe I can add a question here about not quite pre-post-production, but about the way that you work with Katrine and also your sons. In this film, and also very strikingly in Why is Yellow, the Middle of the Rainbow, the portrait that we see there indicates a deeply, deeply collaborative relationship between you and your family as an artistic endeavor. That seems to me to be very striking. Just
okay, I think, first of all, maybe Philippines, maybe the extended family is much more reality. Probably in the industrial countries, the schedules of people are very much more fixed and people are flung apart. My sons were always around, and was probably the most organic process to have them participate in your film. I'm not talking only about because the cheapest actors are your family. Katrine, did I ever pay you?
Oh, well.
But, I mean, I consider myself the cheapest actor available and always on call. My sons were... Yeah, if you just said, hey, let's do this thing, yeah, okay, everybody would jump on the train and we would go and shoot. Of course, as they got older, they also began to have their own schedules. But in the last year, it worked pretty well. And all I did was ask them to play themselves. Kidlat, my oldest son, is really, he edits and does... video, so he's the guy who is editing the karaoke music about Magella, and then my youngest son who is doing the mosaic tiles. I just asked him, okay, do your own thing, and we just include the language lesson, and which they were also doing. They were trying to teach Talipay two languages, so it was easy for them to talk to the film. And Kawayan, who's a painter and really a artist who dabbles in everything, is perfect for the role. So, and then Katrine, yes, Katrine is a curator of that gallery and
sideline.
I think that was how the casting happened without employing upgrade. $100,000 Hollywood casting agent.
Do we have another
hand? Did I answer the question?
Up? Yes, thank you, beautifully. Do we have another hand up in the audience? Okay, that lady in the back.
Hello, I'm just wondering, in terms of reincarnation, because you talk about it in the film. Do you feel like there's a reincarnation link with you and Enrique or something?
You're asking about the incarnation theme that's in the film?
Yes.
Reincarnation.
Reincarnation. Okay. You know, when I was trying to get the film back on track, I realized that I could not by any way have a continuity in the actors. Okay? First of all, Magellan had died 10, 10 years ago. And then I myself, I'm white-haired and I have wrinkles on my face and I have a big belly. How could I try to look like Enrique 35 years ago? I mean, again, if I had a lot of money and I could find as a casting agent to look somebody who looked like me, has a tenure of my voice, probably somewhere in the world they could find somebody to play the role. But all this inability to create a continuity, but okay, I could also restart, just throw away my whole footage from the 80s and start with a new cast. But again, that's not kind of films making. So I thought, why not? Found a solution, maybe about 5 years ago. I said, why not let them all be reincarnated and they all bump into each other at the Flower Fest in Barrio. But part of my motivation for the reincarnation was partly, yes, my wife and I believe in it as a spiritual window to what we're going to become. And whether we can make films that can sell tickets in the future, next life. I don't know if most of you noticed, there are characters who came back. The photographer in the gallery, that's Pigafetta, played Pigafetta in the 1980s. Katrine played Princess. The Dave Barradas, Apu Lapu, comes, that's one of my recent additions, comes back into the film. And the lady who was at the bookstore was the lady who sold, that was a Chinese merchant who sold Enrique. Maybe I got stuck a little bit on a reincarnation theme because I wanted to resurrect the actual actors who played in 1980. 79 until 85 or 86. And I finally got most of them back on the front of camera, despite their age. As a matter of fact, the laptop had almost died because he was under the healing of a particular faith healer who probably messed up with the spirits more than healed him. So these kinds of things enter the story, and in a way, reincarnation. I included that discussion of reincarnation because I thought I would elaborate it more. But for those who saw the reincarnation in the visuals of the characters, that connects with that particular conversation. Was that the nature of your question about the reincarnation discussion?
Not really, I think. The question was whether you believe that between you and Enrique there is a past life or a reincarnation connection.
Okay, yeah. Sometimes I've thought about that and I said maybe the fact that I'm afraid of the sea in this life. Sometimes I go on a boat and I get some chills. And when I'm swimming on the beach, don't go more than 10 meters into the water. Maybe the fact I'm today very afraid of the sea might have been because in the past life I was the daring Enrique.
I think we have a question up front.
Should I go for it? Over the last, over the essay festival, seeing your work, and then yesterday during the masterclass, which you called Straying on Course, you talked about Straying on Course, you talked about taking cosmic guidance for Duende, and you talked about finding a freedom over your life from S plus V equals P, sex violence equals profit. And I just wonder whether when you became aware of your duende, your singular voice, as you put it, whether this was at the time that you tore up your MBA, or was it something that emerged over a lifetime of work and living? Because your practice is not just filmmaking, it's a way of life. So I just, did you get the question? It's when did your duende become your sense of your own path, which you say came cosmically, through cosmic guidance to you. When did you become aware of this? Was it, and how have you got the courage? How did you have the courage very early on to authorize this very singular journey that you've made?
Okay, I think the realization of the duende is a metaphor. It's something that I usually mention so that, especially in the Philippines, we talk about the duende of the forest or the duende of the river. It's a strong esprit that occupies the stone or the river or the forest. And I try to use that metaphor so that Filipinos can understand. But I think it also works well with some concept like the inner child for the Germans and I don't know, the whatever. The thing is that I think I've discovered my duende when I made my first film, The Perfume Nightmare. I think being able to talk about it and use it as a metaphor came maybe more in the 80s when I was teaching at the university in the Philippines. And over the last few years, it's getting more mellow. Somebody mentioned to me that the Garcia Lorca talks about the duende of the flamenco dancer, and I thought maybe that might be the same thing that we're talking about, that inner spark that allows the artist to blossom fully and share what his duende wants to share with the world. It's also for me a metaphor of the uniqueness that makes whether you're a writer or a painter or a filmmaker, that if you break away from the formula because your duende has a different story to tell, and all of us have a unique duende who has that unique frame, you know, the unique frame of looking at the world. And all you have to do is recognize what that uniqueness is. Unfortunately, I think many schools and many, maybe life in general, we're taught formulas. It's much easier to open a hamburger chain and get a franchise from the big franchise owners in America and not have to be creative with doing your own food stand. It's the same with everything else today is being rented, licensed out in terms of formulas. But if your duende has seen the world with its own eyes, or to see with child's eyes, and is brave enough to tell the story in that way, it is definitely, I think, I should start a course, Duende 101.
and long may your duende continue, Kitlat.
I have, over the years, helped a few young filmmakers in the Philippines discover their duende, and I think also a few people outside, but it's more really discovering something that you have inside you as a creative person.
Thank you, Kitlat. On that beautiful note, I believe it's getting pretty late and we're probably about to be turfed out of the building. So I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you very much on behalf of the organizers of the festival for sharing your films with us.
Yeah, I'm sorry that I'm stuck here in Brussels. Just today we were able to go to a little festival in Ghent. As a matter of fact, I met Miranda, who's as a film also in your SA Film Festival.
That's right.
And I'm sorry that I haven't gotten to meet Michael personally and Ricardo.
And is Laura Mulvey around? I was looking forward to meeting her.
Not today, but she did come to quite a few of your screenings.
Okay. And is my niece Anna around, who gave those DVDs to Michael?
She had to go and get the train.
Yeah.
And it's really late.
Thank you very much for doubling up as Kitla Tahimi.
Good. I didn't have to wear a G-string.
And so anyway, at least my bamboo camera got there. And for those of you who probably would take, I mean, especially the what filters out there.
And it was well explained every time, I hope.
Yeah.
It was wonderfully explained.
Anyway, the Cosmos will bring me over, and I hope, Mike, we can do something maybe 10 years from now. When maybe I can transport myself to a laser beam over the internet. Thank you very much, everybody. And look for your duendes and guard it and give it a lot of TLC, and you'll find yourself being the most creative storytellers, whether it's to your grandchildren or whether it's on film. That's all.
Thank you, Kitlat.